Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
McGill.
McGill's been on the line for a little while there because I started up once and then I got all talking all over the recording and I had to start over. But here we are now. It's the 29th of November.
Winter's here. I don't have any snow where I am, but I hear you're under a bunch of snow.
It's okay. I mean, it has been snowing, but at current, it is warm enough that all the snow has melted. Or like
when we get closer to Christmas time, maybe I'll hunt down some funny Christmas-themed D&D things to talk about.
Yeah. I have session 38. You know, this would be episode 39, therefore. And I got Operation Pulse Sphere. And, you know, we've done this bunch, as we've said beforehand, you know. I don't have that much stuff for this episode. And we've always made it work. But, you know, this one I almost considered not saying that. And then I was like,
this time.
Well, the thing is that this time I considered not saying that. And then I was like, but then it's just going to be the first time that I don't say that. It's definitely going to happen. Like, I'm definitely going to have like almost nothing to talk about. This is going to be an interesting session for me in that we are going to have to derive the conversation by what did not happen, perhaps. But we'll have to get
that's intriguing
that when we get
this is
it.
Like a game of password or something. I have to deduce based on what's not being said.
Telephone game's a disgrace. You have a chapter 8, apparently, a wasteland rest stop in your
that's right
post-apoc adventure.
Yeah, there stuff happens. This is not to get into it already, but this is sort of like a waypoint for my adventure party. So things do happen, but it's almost more like a little side quest or maybe a mini mission hub. I'll tell you more when I describe it.
Well, I'm pretty interested to hear about that idea of a mini mission hub, actually. Would you like to kick us off?
Sure. Last adventure, there was a skirmish at a novelty gas station and truck stop that looked like a giant cowboy hat and pair of boots. And the players explored the area. They found some things. They heard a broadcast coming over the radio that provided them with latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates that they're using to sort of track their position and head towards the source of the signal or wherever the signal's pointing them, which is also hopefully in the same direction as Passage, the settlement that they've been heading towards for the past few adventures. There was a dust-up when some Omegas arrived. There were some casualties, and they got back on the road again. A storm kicked up as well. So we pick up as the group continues driving to Passage. They pass by a sign that indicates the city limits. There are no signs of life. Buildings are covered in vines. Lawns are overgrown. They're in the suburbs of the city now. The weather begins to clear up. There was a joy buzzer storm last adventure as well, with more ball lightning. But now the skies are getting clear, sun shining overhead, but the mood is still heavy because there was a death recently. They lost a nerd. The players sort of look around and they can see to the west, there's like a sparkling in the air. It's another one of those sort of rift borders, rift boundaries that they've kind of encountered. They passed through one and wound up facing a dinosaur briefly, but they still don't really know what the deal is with them.
Have you ever played any of the Stalker games?
I have, yeah. It's been some time, though.
Got to carry those bolts around so you can throw them at the rift, see if it triggers anything.
Oh yeah, that's right.
You know what I really like about that, so for listeners, in the Stalker game franchise there are these things called anomalies, these basically, like McGill described, sort of shimmering areas in the just sort of shimmering patches in the air that you'll see, and these will be sort of unstable patches of reality that can sometimes have very catastrophic, like, physical effects if you interact with them. And so the way that you sort of clear your path is you have these, you have a collection of an endless collection of metal bolts that you can use to throw at these anomalies, and so you can make sure that it's safe to walk somewhere. But what I want to say is that I love this as a sort of mini game mechanic to Stalker, just because it is maybe the only thing connecting that first person shooter video game franchise to the Stalker movie. The, like, very pensive, visually enthralling film, like Soviet film.
Are they actually related? I thought that was just coincidental.
They actually absolutely are. They
no
are,
way. They I can't are, believe that.
They are both based on a short story called Roadside Picnic, which I believe is much more explicitly about, like, the zone is created by aliens. And both the video game and the movie sort of took that same story and said, well, what if the zone was the zone of alienation that we actually have now in Russia? And yeah, it's just very funny because they took similar but effectively completely different directions with their interpretation of the source material. But there is that little nod of, like, well, in both of them, you throw the piece of metal to make sure it's safe to go where you're going. Because that film, it's one of the things that they do is to make sure it's safe to walk in different areas in the zone. They throw those very same metal bolts.
I did take some inspiration from the Stalker games for the idea of the rifts. And there are, like, they are sort of these distortions of reality, and they could do you harm, but I didn't carry over things like the bolts. Players just have to decide, like, do they want to go through them? Do they want to go around them? And
I mean, they could have just used a 10-foot pole.
They start with a chicken on the end.
But given that in Stalker, certainly the video game, like, they kind of just would sometimes, the anomalies would just have, like a calamitous, like, physics engine effect take place or something. So it's like if you drive a vehicle into an anomaly, sometimes it'll, like, completely flip the car and send it flying, spinning through the air. Like, who knows what it'd do to a 10-foot pole.
I think initially when I was coming up with ideas for this, I had even contemplated sort of randomizing it, and some of the rift walls were solid, so if the players tried to drive into it, they just hit it like a wall. But I don't think that ever actually comes to fruition in the campaign. Even though it wasn't a thing at the time, now I realize that the way I had sort of envisioned these rift walls is very similar to the movie Annihilation. I guess the book as well. But yeah, the movie has, I guess they even call it, like, the shimmer, where that almost like gasoline in a puddle, that kind of weird, you know, multicolored swirls kind of hovering in the air.
The all-female remake of Stalker, Annihilation.
Yeah.
Which could have also been called Suicide Squad.
Oh. So the players can see one of those rift walls sparkling in the air, and they pass a sign that has some landmarks written on it. Lake Tap, 10, Joint Base Lewis McChord, 25, Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge, 30, Mount Rainier National Park, 40, Olympia, 50. And none of the players themselves... Or sorry, none of the characters knew where these were. None of the players did either, but I later learned that a few of them looked those, like, noted them down and then looked them up in their spare time to get a sense of where they actually were in the world. And we know it's just outside of Seattle.
I think I would have caught Olympia, to be honest.
Yeah. So after about an hour, The road ahead gets clogged up with decrepit vehicles, just rotting, rusting hulks of old cars, a dead traffic jam. And so they can weave through the first like three or four, but soon there are just too many piled up in the road, and they have to get out of the car, stretch their legs, and they decide that they're going to spread out a bit and check the cars to see if there's any gas, if there's anything of use inside them, just scavenge the area. And far ahead, like looking ahead, they can see at the front of the car jam, there is the shimmering wall of a rift. They have no idea how high it is or how far along it goes. And occasionally they can see these arcs of energy crackling across its surface. And so they start getting out. Who was it? Ralph starts. He immediately starts like grabbing corpses that he finds, and everybody's giving him the side eye, and he can't talk, of course, but they quickly realize that he's actually looking for footwear. He's been barefoot this whole time, and so he keeps on like holding up corpses' shoes next to his feet to try and find some that fit him. I had them rolling some search checks and just scavenging around. I also I have a few tables from the D20 post-apocalypse where it's just like mundane stuff that you can find from scavenging. Things like, you know, batteries or a length of rope or zip ties, just regular stuff that you might find around, but that could also be useful, a whistle. And then suddenly startled.
Would like non-perishable food items qualify in that list, or would that be a separate list?
You know what? I think it's a separate list, but let me pull it up. I should really have had this ready to go when we started.
It's a question of like, do you roll on a table and get the result non-perishable food, roll on non-perishable food table, or perishable food, roll on perishable food table, and then it's like the perishable food table has like a still good and a spoiled version for every possible thing you roll.
Let me see here. I'm pretty sure that they don't actually yeah, here we go. So equipment. It doesn't look like there's any real food on here. Things like a backpack, batteries, binoculars, book, a briefcase, cigarette lighter, compass, digital camera, duct tape, fatigues, a fire extinguisher, first aid kit, a flashlight, a road atlas, mechanical toolkit, parka, rope, a two-person tent, a tool belt, walkie-talkie, windbreaker, zip tie. So that's just like the miscellaneous one.
I mean, the one that really jumped out at me there was book. What kind of book? You need a whole other table for the different types of books. Could be a comic book. Could be a dirty magazine. Could be a dictionary.
Could be. Well, rather than roll on a table for those, I often just specify it. Like, it's a novel. But there might be, you know, there are some other tables in here, like survival gear. It gets in deeper. Sleeping bags, portable stove, mesh vests, gas masks, computers and electronics, professional equipment such as handcuffs, a percussion instrument, a lockpick set, a medical kit.
Man, percussion instrument, that's another one. Like, so what I would often do in a situation like this is like I would get that result, but I'd be like, that's not specific enough. But then I go on Google and I type like list of types of blank, like like types of book or something, and then I'd find some like list on Wikipedia, then I'd eyeball it about how many entries it looked like, and then I'd pick a dice that was appropriate to that many, and I'd roll, and I'd count up, and then I'd say it was whatever I rolled up.
And I would usually just make it up. If it's not an actual plot item and it's something like a book that's unlikely to be used for anything other than just sort of character beats, right? Like, what are they going to? They're just going to read a book. And if it's not something that I have incorporated into any grand plot, I'll just sort of make it up on the fly, like 101 dirty jokes.
I just think that you might get some inspiration from the randomness. That's what I work on.
Certainly. I'm certainly not discouraging it. It's just not what I do. If I was rolling up some random stuff, I'd usually just make it up on the fly. So they're scavenging these cars, and suddenly a radio comes on with a blast of static and then a voice. This actually harkens back to something we talked about on a previous episode. The reason that you start the show by saying, "Greetings, listeners." Uh-huh. So a voice comes on and says, "Chaos in the city as reported by our scouts. Some say the fires burn so brightly they could be seen across the bay. This concludes the daily bulletin broadcast brought to you by Dunbar's Trading Post. Everything you need for your next trip through the wastes. And now, dear listeners, I have to use the little girl's room, so Miss V will be back after this track from the stacks." And music starts playing. So I do have a post-apocalyptic DJ a la Fallout. And so as this is going on,
the thing unbeknownst is, you know, Fallout is limited by, their resources. They can only have, they generally only have one DJ per game. You can introduce multiple DJs and have like a quest line where they're fighting each other or something.
I didn't quite go that far, but I will say that this broadcast, there are multiple DJs, and this radio tower is located in Passage. So the radio broadcast will come back. The players will eventually wind up at the radio station. While this is going on, unbeknownst to the players...
Ooh, I just want to say that would be a good time to use the audio log technique that my friend came up with.
Yeah, absolutely. If I had had more time, I probably would have done it. I do play music, though. Like, whenever I mention that music's playing, like that DJ gave that message and then went into a song, I'll just put on a song. I always like the kind of the Fallout franchise. I like the way that they kind of scored it using older music, like music from the 50s, a lot of doo-wop and some like twangy, Johnny guitar kind of tracks. I would bump it up and do like 1970 music, classic rock, maybe some surf rock in there.
I had a phenomenal mod for Fallout 4, which actually added a radio station that included all these people had recorded like in universe like ads and like radio plays and stuff. So like radio plays that were set in the world of Fallout before the apocalypse and made reference to all the companies and whatnot. And then they'd have like ads for the different food you could find, like Fancy Lads snack cakes and whatnot.
That's awesome. Do you remember what that mod is called?
Atomic Radio for Fallout 4.
Awesome. Well, when I eventually play Fallout 4, I will look that up.
I highly recommend it.
So I mentioned before that the players like look around. They can see they take note of the weather. They take note of this rift wall that's ahead. Unbeknownst to them, the check that I had them make to get all those details, they had all failed because there are, in fact, two other people skulking around amidst the cars, two fellow wastelanders. One is a gangly 14-year-old kid who is, his name's Jacob, and he's siphoning gas from the cars and trucks. And he wears dark brown and dark green clothing, camo pants, and he has a cape and a cowl. They're made out of a net that's filled with leaves, so it's really good camouflage. And then keeping watch from a higher vantage point just off to the side is his dad, Ernest, who is watching them through a hunting rifle with a scope. And so let's see here. Yeah, he's dressed similarly to Jacob, lots of camo, dark greens and browns. He has a leafy cape and a hood of his own. He carries a hunting rifle that has a knife taped to the end as a makeshift bayonet, has a big scope. And he has told Jacob that the party are Omegas because they're driving a car that has a big Omega symbol on the front of it. And so he says, you know, those are Omegas, and the women in their party are probably prisoners. And so he said to Jacob, if you need me to shoot someone, point your finger like a gun at that person. And so this confrontation went pretty interestingly. The players eventually happened upon Jacob siphoning gas, and he sort of staggers backwards and he puts his hands up, and the players draw their guns and are kind of hostile because they just had an encounter with the Omegas. So they're on edge and you know, demanding to know who he is, and Ralph being like the biggest one of them, and he's totally quiet. Jacob is immediately scared of him. And so he does the thing where he sort of points his finger gun at Ralph, and Ralph gets clipped in the shoulder with a shot from an unknown source. But it creates sort of a funny moment where the players don't really understand what happened because he doesn't actually have a gun. And then after a moment, they realize, oh, he's got someone covering him. So there's a very brief little dust up where the players all take cover, but eventually they manage to sort of talk down Ernest and Jacob and, you know, realize that everybody here is actually just peaceful and not, we're not talking about more Omegas or another threat. Lots of diplomacy roles go on here, and eventually, like, okay, everybody calms down. Ernest comes out from his hiding spot. Everything is resolved peacefully, and Ernest apologizes for shooting Ralph when he realizes that these aren't actually Omegas, and in fact, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, so maybe they should all be on the same side. And he invites the players back to their home to patch up Ralph and, you know, maybe give them a good meal and give them a safe place to rest. So the players go with Ernest and Jacob. Ernest and Jacob pull a small fallen tree aside to reveal a worn dirt road leading alongside the edge of the road where all the cars are piled up, and he leads them deep into the forest off the side of the road. The road is wide enough that they can slowly guide the truck along it. Jacob and Ernest walk ahead of the vehicle, occasionally stopping to move a fallen tree trunk. The truck passes, and then they replace it afterwards, like covering their tracks. And after about 20 minutes, they arrive at Ernest and Jacob's place. So I should say that at the time when I wrote this, I was heavily into the game Wasteland 2. And so there are little bits of things here that I took inspiration from, and really just the whole setting, this whole idea of, like, you know, going off to the side of the main quest, meeting a couple of NPCs, and opening up a lot of little conversation trees and things, all just very inspired by interactions from Wasteland 2. And
checked out Wasteland 3 yet?
I haven't checked out Wasteland 3. I have it installed. I'm going to play it next, or maybe not next, but very soon. Because I've been looking forward to that one. I really liked Wasteland 2. I even got the high-def remaster of Wasteland 1 that I'll probably play at some point. So Ernest and Jacob's home could best be described as a fortified compound. The main buildings are constructed from two big rig truck trailers parked parallel to each other. Doors have been cut into their sides and a walkway connects them. A shuttle van without tires rests on top of the first trailer. A tall wall made of junk, corrugated metal sheets, and car doors surrounds the structure. The yard has two large garden beds growing vegetables. And on the other side of the trailers, there are about 100 feet of trees, and beyond that, a small lake. So they've got, like, their back up against the water. As the players step into the yard, a four-legged robot, like a metal dog with a turtle shell, bounds out from under the closest trailer, charges across the grass, and then it skids to a halt in the dirt in front of the party, menacing everyone with a pair of rusty shotguns that are strapped to its sides. Its internal mechanisms whir threateningly. And the design of this robot is definitely taken from Wasteland 2, because they have the sort of bigger scorpion robots. I wanted just a smaller four-legged one that acts like a dog. And it's funny, when we started this podcast, my sense of time this year is all off. But earlier this year, I was playing Shadowrun Hong Kong, And there's a character in there who has a bunch of robots that are sort of like his pets, but you can also use them to like hack things and climb through vents and stuff. Those robots were basically what I had in mind with this robot, which is, you know, small robot pet, basically. And this guy's name is Tapper. So Ernest goes, "Whoa, Tapper, hold on." The robot relaxes a bit and bounces on its spindly legs. And Ernest goes, "Tapper, initiate guestbook protocol." And he turns to the party, goes, "Hold still." And the robot scans everybody. Ernest also crouches down to Rosa's height. And he says, "Don't worry, little lady. He's a softie." So the robot scans everyone and then just acts a bit like a dog. You know, it's happy to see them and runs around the yard. Ernest heaves his backpack off his shoulder and he says, "Jacob, why don't you show our guests around? They might want to sleep." Jacob lights up and he goes, "Sure, come on this way," and leads you inside. And then I have some descriptions of the compound here. In the dining room and kitchen, there's a big hamster wheel that Tapper the robot stomps along inside of to charge the batteries. Jacob, this is great because, you know, Jacob's giving them the tour, so I can really give an in-depth description of everything. Jacob runs over, he connects a cable that hangs from the ceiling to the side of the robot, and he says, "We run this whole place off car batteries, and the battery in Tapper holds more charge than car batteries, so we use him to help power the place." Next to the hamster wheel, there's a countertop made of someone's front door with, you know, knives and a camper stove and things on top of it. Convention center folding plastic table makes up the dining room table, and there are overturned buckets that are being used as stools. There's a ham radio on a desk at the far end of the trailer, a hand-drawn map hanging on the wall above the desk. All of these things, of course, will be useful to the players eventually. In the second of the big rig trailers, there are camping cots. There is a big piece of chain link fence with a metal frame that sections off half the trailer. And beyond that, they can see shelves of supplies, bottled water, packaged food, lanterns, flares, tents, sleeping bags, gas masks, clothes, a rack of guns, melee weapons, a fire axe, a machete. And in one corner stands a metal rack with a complete fireman's uniform on it. And I'll admit, I was putting this here hoping that maybe the players would be scumbags and break in there and steal some things, the way, you know, tends to happen on a show like The Walking Dead or something. But they didn't. They didn't. Ernest has discovered, you know, he goes out and he looks around the property to see if anything has gone wrong in their absence. And he discovered that the windstorm that the players encountered earlier broke the propeller on their wind farming generator, and a few other sections of the wall, the outer wall, have collapsed. And so, once the party gets all back together and Jacob prepares some food for everybody, Ernest says, "We can repair the propeller. It would only be a temporary fix. What we really need is a new propeller that can withstand strong winds. There's a suburb to the east of here where we might be able to find something. It's pretty picked over, but I don't think anyone has thought to salvage ceiling fans or something like that. If I can trouble some of your group to come with me, we'd be in your debt. Jacob, you stay here. Maybe the quiet giant can assist in repairing the walls." And so what I've done, I split up the group, and I give them each a mini quest. Rosa helps Jacob repair the propeller temporarily. And while they're doing that, while they've climbed up to the top of the propeller for the wind farming generator, they spot a deer. And Jacob says, "Oh, if we catch that, we can have a feast tonight." So then he and Rosa go off on their little side quest to hunt a deer. Ralph helps fix Ralph and Sadie help repair the walls, fixing it just with, you know, chain link and corrugated metal. And I believe the nerds stayed behind, but Doc and Critter and Beulah went with Ernest to the suburb, and they start, you know, scavenging the area, searching in all the buildings, and they have a few, there are three encounters that I had for them. While scavenging, and of course scavenging the buildings, they I have to make them roll the usual scavenging checks. Sorry?
Say, gotta make them checks.
Yeah, gotta make them checks. Gotta make sure they don't, like, fall through the ground or have pieces of the walls fall on them or anything like that. And while they're scavenging and just, you know, rolling on those miscellaneous items tables, finding anything that might be useful, at one point, they go down to the basement and they find two slods asleep in the basement of the house that has a torn out wall. And so there's an encounter where they fight the slods, but thankfully the slods don't like light, so they can escape the monsters just by going back outside. But, you know, they have a little dust up there. The team finds a downed two-seater Cessna airplane that has an intact propeller, so they take that, completing that, grabbing that quest item, basically. And then also the third encounter that they had was Beulah opens a door in a house and sees, like, a bloated corpse, but it's, like, twitching and flopping on the ground like it's having a seizure. And she calls over Doc, because he was an EMT. He obviously has some sort of medical experience, and they're like, we don't know what it is. And he goes over and sort of prods it with his foot, and then the body splits open and a huge multi-legged insect comes out. It's sort of, I basically just used an ankh hag from D&D, comes out. It's almost 6 feet long and over a foot in diameter, and they're just, like, disgusting, and they freak out, and so they have a fight with the big insect. And it was funny because while they were doing this, they had sort of split off into smaller groups to search the buildings rather than all four of them going building by building. And so Beulah and Doc, like, have this encounter, and then they run back outside and meet with Critter and Ernest. And then Critter and Ernest are like, is everything okay? And they're like, yeah, just never mind, moving on. And so they head back, and this adventure ended with Rosa and Jacob. They catch the deer. And it ends with a big feast at the compound. Walls are repaired, and everybody feels safe for the moment while they ponder their next play, ponder their next move.
It's quite a gig for Ernest and Jacob, for just two dudes.
Well, I did have. I don't think the players actually even learned this, but it started off. There were, like, five of them. Jacob's mom, Ernest's wife, passed away at some point, and they had two other survivors who had helped them out, but, you know, some awful post-apocalyptic encounter had resulted in them dying, and it's down to just Ernest and Jacob there, who are very thankful, of course, that the party came along when they did.
Makes sense. So you said that this was, like, a mini quest hub?
Well, I mean, that's most of it there, where everybody gets a job to do. Everybody gets their own checks and things. You know, Ralph had to do strength checks and repair checks to repair the walls. And then the group who went into the suburbs, they had their quest item and also, you know, their combat encounters. And Rosa and Jacob, they had to do repair checks and then survival checks to do the hunting. So it was all these sort of, like, mini quests with one major quest item at the center. And I admit I haven't looked ahead in my notes. Pretty sure there are a couple more things that they do while they're there.
Man, what killed Kenny this time?
What did kill Kenny? Maybe Kenny got killed by... Kenny's the one who went over and poked the twitching body.
Oh,
the big
man,
insect
definitely.
Comes out and eats him immediately.
Definitely, definitely. He, like, gets he gets caught because it pops out and he's like, whoa, this is, like, the thing, and then it kills him.
Whoa! Humph. Well, bye, Kenny.
Game over, man. So, on to my operation, then.
Yeah, let's do it.
Operation Pulse Sphere. So, MPOC's finest are back in Austin, the human capital, which is due to be celebrating Dwarven Alliance Day just around the corner. But this is kind of an important one because things haven't been going so well for Austin. So it's important that the city make good relations with the Dwarven people so that they're... the relationship between the humans of Austin and the dwarves of Arden can continue as they have, so that to the prosperity of the city. But there is an additional faction of angry elven magi who are hoping to stir a conflict that will disrupt Dwarven Alliance Day and encourage a war between Settlers Green, the elven state, and Austin, which is only just reconstructed after some major calamities. However, basically, so last time, Operation Inner Lighthouse, the party got here, they got the lay of the land, they went around, they learned about the important places, the important people, they, Goblin Pickpocket tried to get him, they, hit him with Feeble Mind, and...
Oh, that's right, they completely stupefied a random pickpocket.
And, when they were sent to the city, they were also told about, different merchants that had special items on sale that they might find useful. One item that they did pick up from that is what's called a figurine of wondrous power from 5e. I just wanted to shine a little spotlight on this. Figurines of wondrous power are basically little figurines of animals that you can use every so often, depending what the figurine is, to have that figurine turn into that animal as a companion or assistant or whatever. And when the animal is dead or is killed, or when the time limit runs out, the animal reverts back to its figurine form. And a lot of
I'm just going to foreshadow here that one of the things I'm going to talk about in the tavern is actually kind of like that.
Interesting. So, they're generally pretty neat. There's one that I find very funny. So the one that the party got was, I think it's a silver raven, and it's basically a raven that you can use as like a scout. What's funny is that there is an ebony fly figurine among the figurines of wondrous power. And I always thought that that would be another like, you know, literally like a fly on the wall. Like it's a spy device. Actually, it turns into a big fly about the size of a horse. It has its own stats that are given on the item, and it's like you get to fly around on a fly. It's pretty wild.
That's pretty metal, but yeah. I could also see it being troublesome. It's like, oh no, that, you know, I'm trying to fly into battle, but that hapless merchant spilt his barrel of honey.
I think that
my mount keeps getting distracted by these piles of horse shit.
The silver raven, as a scouting device, like to basically have, it's kind of like a familiar that you turn around to, see where you cannot see. And that's a pretty useful device to have in this situation where they're in the city and they're trying to figure out by what means this terrorist plot is operating. And what they eventually figured out was that they must have been operating through the sewers somehow. What they had figured out in the previous operation was that there was a smuggling operation that someone had been made to take the fall for, which was not necessarily connected to the terrorist plot, but now that the terrorist threat existed, those responsible for the smuggling operation needed to cut all ties as quickly as possible. So they made a fall guy, you know, take the fall. But that at least told the characters, like, okay, so we're dealing with runners who are able to enter the city through some means. And they figured out that the means was through the sewers. Basically, the sewers emptied out to nearby waterfalls. And they determined that there must be people like finding their way up the waterfall and then sneaking in through the sewers. And so the plan, the plot as they understood it, was that the terrorists were going to infiltrate the city during Dwarven Alliance Day or around Dwarven Alliance Day, and then, you know, cause major incidents of sabotage at, like, for example, there was going to be a big bard show, and so that was going to be sabotaged, and there was also going to be some sabotage in the sewers itself that was going to cause, like, a street cave-in sort of thing. None of that happened, though.
All this talk of Dwarven Alliance Day makes me want to celebrate Dwarven Alliance Day.
I mean, yeah. It's too bad the characters... I mean, they did get a fair bit of time in the previous op to just wander around the city and enjoy it. And I had random encounters, like the one with the pickpocket. There was, like, a runaway ox-driven carriage at one point. They ran into a town drunk, that sort of thing. But going to this operation, Operation Pulse Sphere, what I had planned as the DM was that these elven terrorists would be moving through the sewers with, like, bombs or whatever they were planning to attack the city with. So they were moving their supplies through and infiltrating through the sewers, and the players were going to go down in the sewers and stop them. And then they were going to, like, figure out where they were coming from, which was the waterfalls, and they'd have a run-in with some of these Arcmagi at the waterfalls, and they'd realize that the Arcmagi had sort of, like, set up their base essentially up the waterfalls. This is actually something that I had gone into some research into how you could do this in Dungeons and Dragons. And the spell Layman's Tiny Hut is a spell, it's third level evocation, I believe, where you basically summon up a tiny hut that can hold up to 9 people, and it's generally like you create a shelter for yourself that you can go into and long rest and whatnot. But also in this situation, the Magi had used their abilities to sort of create these tiny huts as sort of like hidden areas where the terrorists could hide out along the waterfall outside the city, outside the sewers. And
I want one that summons a tiny banana stand.
Yeah, well, that's a 9th level spell called Alphabaz, and you need to something to turn into it. But hey, the bigger the thing, the bigger the banana stand. So that's a plus. The thing is, I had not accounted for what my brother, Valfarain Draglengai, the black metal dragonborn bard, came up with as a solution to this operation. He said, okay, so they're trying to infiltrate the city through the sewers. So he cast Arcane Mirage, which lets you basically use illusion magic to, like, rework, to redefine the terrain in, like, a square mile. You can make thorny brambles show up. You can make big gaps appear where they aren't. You can make, like, walls where they aren't. You can basically make a place seem, or for all intents and purposes, be impassable. And what he did was he cast Mirage Arcane in the sewers such that the sewers no longer led or no longer appeared to lead to the sewer exits into the city. The sewers were now effectively a closed circuit that was just passages that all ended. It's like a maze that all the paths eventually go back to where you started. And for this, the players barely even needed to go into the sewers. It was just like he did this, and then I was like, well, then they're just never going to get there. And I guess that solved the operation. So this is why I said I don't have a lot to talk about, is that's literally one spell. They solved the operation with one spell.
Was it a short session?
It was a short session. There was the advantage that I had built out this city of Austin, and there was still places for them to go and explore and whatnot. But it was very jarring for me. I had never had to that extent. Certainly at that point, I don't think any session previously had hit me to that extent with like, oh, wow, I hadn't seen that coming. And that literally changes everything. Like, rather than ever having to engage with the terrorists, they just made it literally impossible for the terrorists to complete their objective. Because the terrorist plot was to come in through the sewers, and he just reformed the sewers so that, like, they could not possibly find their way through. I thought it was pretty brilliant, to be honest. And it kind of tickles me. Like, obviously, it would be irritating if this happened often, but it kind of tickles me to be like, wow, that's the power level we're at, is that they have spells that are so powerful that, like, if I have a task that is, like, simple enough, they will literally just solve it by casting a spell. And it's, like, I would say certainly that now all of my operations are designed to have, like, more layers than that, I would say. Like, I think that nowadays it would never just be stop the terrorists coming in through the sewers. It would be like, well, you do that, but then there's also this other thing that needs to happen. Like, I tend to have more stages to my operations nowadays, which means generally that they take longer to run, but it also means that, like, you know, you can have someone do a clever solution like this, and it doesn't just end the op right there. It's like, oh, well, that solves one part of it, then we go on to the next. And that can be very enjoyable and satisfying for players. Certainly, I really enjoy using, like, a really creatively using a utility spell in a way that, like, really becomes important. I had mentioned previously how I had once used Demiplane to, like, take all the gold from an evil dragon's treasury, rendering him effectively broke, even though he had taken over a nation. That's the kind of thing where it's like, don't think the DM accounted for it, but it's hell of a move.
Yeah, if that happened to me, I totally would be rethinking, like, okay, this was too easy. I lowballed this too badly. Time to up the challenge rating, or at least add more missions.
And so would you do that, like, there on the spot? Or is that something that you would simply bear in mind going forward with this arc?
I'd probably bear it in mind going forward. Like, I wouldn't improvise more complications necessarily, but what I probably would do, especially if the session looked, you know, like I had budgeted for 3 hours and they were done in the first half hour, I would start running random encounters. I'd roll up some random encounters, and maybe even I have a lot of, like, specific encounter tables that are like forest encounters, city encounters, that are not just like an encounter with an opponent, but could easily be built into an adventure hook. So I'd probably bust out something like that and wing it that way, so that it gives the players more to do, but I'm not messing around too much with, like, the grander plot of my campaign.
Right. Like, I think That basically is in line with what happened for me, because, like I say, the advantage was that I had already sort of set up Austin as a city, and I did have sort of a small list of, like, city encounters that could happen. Like I mentioned, like a runaway ox-driven cart and the goblin pickpocket, which I also mentioned. But yeah, it was basically just the players sort of figured out what the elven terrorist plot, like, they figured out that the runners must be coming through the sewers, and then Valfar, they got to the sewers, and Valfar was like, I have a spell that I think could literally, like, undo this whole problem, and then he cast it, and from there, it was just kind of like, you know, they did, they went back to the nobles and sort of reported their success or reported what was happening. And that allowed me to sort of accelerate things towards like, okay, well then we have to figure out where they came from. And that did eventually move things to like discovering that they had set up on the waterfalls. But the thing is that like the operation for them dealing with that, that had been what I planned for the next operation basically. So while I could effectively set up right to the beginning, the next operation saying like, okay, so you figure out that the sewers would empty out onto the waterfall. And so they must be coming up that way. And so they went and explored sort of the waterfall, and that's where they detect like the tiny magical huts and whatnot. And then it was like, all right, well, so we're going to go back into the city. We're going to tell the nobles, we're going to like get some force behind us. And then we're going to try and drive these elves out of the waterfall area. But yeah, we didn't like that was all the actual action of that would then happen the next operation. And so, yeah, this was just a very short one for me, which, you know, every certainly at the time. You know, we were getting together in person. We'd get together in the evening. Like people would tend to be a bit tired. And so like, I think every once in a while people were grateful for like a shorter session. But this one just happened to be like abnormally shorter, like probably an hour shorter rather than a half hour.
Yeah. You know, like if I ever get frustrated by those kinds of situations, it's when it's something like a spell that a player took when they leveled up that I didn't know about. Because, you know, generally as a DM, you can track all the items pretty well. Any items, especially magical ones that the players get, are generally bestowed upon them by you. But spells they can take on their own. So, you know, it's not like frustrating in a really bad way, but I can't think of a specific instance, but I know it has definitely happened at least once where I've presented the players with some scenario and somebody's been like, oh, well, I just took this spell that can literally undo that with a snap of the fingers.
Yeah.
And then you just go like, shoot. Yeah, they're right.
I can't really make that excuse with Mirage Arcane because I actually mentioned Valfar using it in a previous operation. Cause he used it back when they were in the Deathlands. So, yeah.
So it's all on you.
Yeah. I just hadn't considered it being used in this way. It is a really like remarkable spell in like how it can be used. Like totally sort of redefining the features of a square mile area. Like the area keeps its general shape, but if you can do something like make illusory walls at any number of points or create new turns in like a series of corridors, that's serious business. So yeah, that's really all I have to say about that operation, but I'll certainly have a whole bunch more to say about the next one.
You know, that's really not that much less time than you usually spend talking about your operations anyway.
Yeah, it's less, but yeah, it could be worse.
Well,
I guess that just means it's onwards to the tavern for tavern time.
Drown your sorrows with a flagon of ale at the tavern of the non-Euclidean Tavern of Corners.
I brought something goofy that I may have mentioned at the end of the last one.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, you should probably do that then.
Man, all right. So there exists a game created on the internet, a role-playing game called Dungeons the Dragoning 40,000 7th Edition. And it is, in fact, that first release, as you would call it, is in its final 1.6 form as it is. I downloaded it. It is a free download. You can find it online. You kind of have to track it down one way or another. Like the links that I had initially followed did not quite lead me there. And like, this kind of just speaks to the kind of the nature of it. Like there is internet lore behind this thing, this artifact. And then there is like what I believe to be the reality of it. So internet lore holds that someone created this and basically posted it in 4chan. And when asked like how they created it, they said like, oh, I did it on a dare. But that seems unlikely to me because this feels like a role-playing game that was written by 4chan. It feels like that if one person literally did this on a dare, that person somehow is like a human embodiment of the traditional game section of 4chan. And that comes with, you know, it comes with baggage. Revisiting it, I found it like perhaps, I don't necessarily want to say more problematic, but maybe more likely to be problematic than I originally thought of it. Like, it has this intro, which I remembered some of, where it talks about, like, could you create the perfect role-playing game? And it says, let me see if I can actually find the words, the line. Right. So the line here is a man not entitled to the grandest of adventure? No, says the man with the neck beard. It would be unbalanced. No, says the man in the high heels. It wouldn't be deep enough. No, says the man on the internet. The new edition ruins everything forever. I have rejected those answers. Instead, I chose something different. I chose the impossible. I chose Dungeons the Dragoning. A game where the fighter would not fear the wizard, where the cleric would not be nerfed, where the great would not be constrained by the small. And with the roll of your dice, Dungeons the Dragoning can be your game as well. It is, it has a very kind of, like, aggressive, masculine tone to it that I think is very of a time. It reminds me of, like, you know, like, Maddox and stuff. That kind of, like, internet culture.
Man, yeah, that takes me back.
So, like...
like Tucker Max.
Yeah, I mean, he... the thing is, he's so much worse. Maddox is actually kind of trying to be a force for good these days, which is funny. I think he's really gone back on a lot of the old stuff that like he made his money on. But anyways, whatever the case, revisiting it, it's like the tone of it is kind of like it's kind of cringy, to be honest. As is practically everything to do with, like, you know, 4chan, all that. You know, you can have your... There's great stuff from TG that is, like, classic, you know, role-playing game stuff. I particularly like the Ballad of Eduardo, which I may bring up sometime. But all of that is, like, I always remember it more fondly than, like, if I revisit it, I'm like, oh, yeah, you can really tell that this is, like, from 4chan. But I think that what's fascinating about Dungeons & Dragons, Dungeons the Dragoning 40,007th Edition, is the manner in which the creator has chosen to combine different elements of, like, established role-playing games. Like, certainly when I look through the role-playing, the rule book of Dungeons the Dragoning 7th edition, 40,007th edition, sorry, I recognize all over the place where they are taking things from. You brought last time the map of Cliché, and this is like, it's like that to a greater degree, because it's like there are things that you will immediately recognize if you're familiar with Warhammer, with World of Darkness. Particularly, it's funny, like I always think of old World of Darkness as being the more popular one, but this system has very specifically taken a lot from New World of Darkness, which is the one I'm more familiar with Vampire the Requiem. And I think I mentioned in the past there was the spin-off game that they made for that, Promethean, which was about like Frankenstein type monsters, like simulacrums of life that are not truly alive. And they have taken that premise to make a Promethean like subclass that is effectively like, this is the this is any character that is like of an artificial origin, like if you are a cyborg or a robot or whatever. But I may be getting ahead of myself. Your character in if you look at the character sheet for the game, it clearly looks like a character sheet for New World of Darkness. But then also, if you look at the class system, it is clearly the class system from the Warhammer role-playing games, like that one that we played with previously where you got the burger result, remember? Like the career path one. Except they have much more generalized career paths, including things like Fight Guy and Master Fight Guy. But they still have Rat Catcher. But
honestly, this really feels very like Munchkin.
Well, the thing is, I don't like Munchkin because it's not really a role-playing game, you know? Like, this game, they have actually created, like, it is a very obtuse system that's like, oh, what if we took a bit of every system? So it's like, you roll a dice pool that, God, it's like the way that dice rolls are written is so bizarre. Like, you get if you have a hindrance, it's like, you receive a minus one KO to rolls of this or whatever. It's like, what the fuck does that mean? But of course, it's what it's doing is it's mixing, like in New World of Darkness, you use dice pools. So instead of rolling one dice, you roll a number of dice and you roll more dice if you have a higher stat. But then they've mixed that with like, say D20 or something else, or even Warhammer, so that you've got like a dice pool of say like D6s and D20s, and you're looking to like meet a certain requirement or something. But I guess, so when you create a character in Dungeons the Dragoning 40,000 7th edition, you pick your race, you pick your exaltation, and you pick your class. And your race is like, you know, that's pretty standard. You have dwarves, elves, halflings, tieflings, orcs, what have you. Then your exaltation is basically no character in the way they put it in the book is a hero may be many things, but a hero is never a mere man. And so it's basically this idea of like, you're not just a hero. You're like you're not just an orc warrior. You're an orc werewolf warrior or an orc cyborg warrior, or like that's where the Promethean comes in, or you're a vampire or a demon. Like, there's no option that is not extra. The closest you can get is you can be a paragon, in which case you are like the epitome of whatever you are.
So this is just like a system exclusively for power gaming, is what I'm
basically hearing. Yeah, it's funny. It actually, as well, in the introduction, it especially tries to enforce this idea that like, this is a game that favors the aggressor. Like, you always want to be pushing in a fight. You never want to be on the defensive. And you always want to be like, but the thing is like, so then you have like, you have the whole combat system, and that is like every possible maneuver, like multiple attacks, disarming an opponent, pushing an opponent, shoving an opponent, like, and that is all, it all feels like the Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game to me, as does the class system, which again is like this career system where it's like you start at one thing and then you move up to the next thing, but you can jump around between different careers. So it's like you can start off as a rat catcher, then move to be, say, a mercenary, then you maybe dabble as a rogue, but then you can buy different stats and buy into like sorcerer, and then, you know, jump around like that and become this sort of multi-class, like your class is rather the summary of all the different careers you've specialized in and done. And so by the end, what you have is like an orc werewolf who is trained in magic, but also rogue and warrior abilities, and also has a bit of cleric. And everybody, your alignment is, instead of having alignment, everybody has a god. And one that I thought was worth mentioning is one of the gods is called Vectron, and his whole, like, his summary is, this is a very real god that is definitely not made up.
And, hail Vectron, by yeah. Vectron's kindly claw.
Yeah. I'm sure some people will get the reference. Others might not. But,
that's great. Yeah, now I want to make a character whose patron is Vectron.
You can be aligned to Vectron. You could be an orc my idea was for an orc Promethean sorcerer that's dedicated to Vectron.
I just like to do like a paladin or a cleric of Vectron, and the main gimmick being every time, every exclamation and every like action or spell has to include some reference to Vectron.
Yep.
I cast light by Vectron's brilliant eyes.
So anyways, it's also funny to like look through the setting and everything and see how, like, so they've basically taken the omnipresent idea in all of these games of like there was an ancient race and everything that we have is because of them. Like the exaltations are the after, you know, the after effects of, you know, being chosen by the ancient race of the Shrine, or I think they call it the Shrine, which in Warhammer would actually be the Slan, which in Vampire I think would be like Cain and the Cainites or whatever. And then, you know, in Dungeons and Dragons you'd have like the Mind Flayers or God, what else have you? There's always the old ones. And similarly, like, they have wholesale taken the setting of Planescape and put that in the game. So, like, Sigil from Planescape and all the factions from Planescape and Sigil are in it. But also, it's this idea of, like, the game takes place at the cross-section of the multiverse wherein Planescape takes place, but also, like, it has sort of the Spelljammer idea that all the worlds have crystal spheres that you have to break out of to get into the multiverse. And like, so the Imperium of Man has just broken out of their crystal sphere. And so like, basically Warhammer has just come to the multiverse. They've taken Modrons from like Dungeons and Dragons and mixed them with Necrons from Warhammer. So Modrons are like silly robots of order, but now they're also terrifying like undead robots that hate all life. And yeah, it's a wild ride that's full of moments where, like, if you are familiar with the properties it is poaching from, you're like, oh, I get it. It's like from that. And to some extent, it's admirable because in some places it's like, oh, they really did just take all the coolest parts from all these things. But at the same time, it is like very much of a tone. It is very sloppy in certain places, although some people apparently totally enjoy it as a role-playing game. It's worth saying that
people actually play it, huh? I mean, well, I shouldn't be surprised.
It was popular enough that there was like a second release that was made as sort of like a community project, and then another release was made. But the way you can tell that people take this game seriously is that the third release has actually been like rendered defunct because it was deemed like completely unbalanced by people who actually cared about the game.
So you're telling me there isn't actually a seventh edition?
No.
Disappointing. Although,
technically, it is 1.6 of seventh edition. But it is interesting to note, like, also, there's a, like, going back to, like, the cringe thing is, like, it has a very long an example of play section, you know, like, these role-playing game books that are like, here's what it looks like to play a role-playing game, and then they have like a written section that is like, so and so does this and they say this and then they roll the dice and whatnot. Have you ever seen these?
Yeah, I think I had a Doctor Who one of those.
Right, so the thing is, from what I could tell, it is like, it's so cringe. Like, the all the characters in the example of play have like really unlikely names. Like, half of them have given themselves Japanese names, and then like, it's really long. Like, it's a really long part of the book. And then I'm pretty sure, like, I didn't read all of it, but the sense I got was that it's mostly just an like a depiction of like annoying table talk, and then nobody actually plays the game, and then they all go home. Like, someone talks about the character they wish they had made, somebody talks, like, it keeps mentioning how they're like grabbing Cheetos, and then like at the end everybody just goes home.
That's kind of great.
Again, very much of a tone.
Have you ever played it?
No. No, I mean,
will you ever play it?
Maybe. It's a bit interesting to me. The thing is, like, it's interesting to me, the idea that people have played it and like set a sense of like what balance is in this game. I'm leery of games like this that feel kind of sloppy or goofy in their construction, because I have played a game of Paranoia, which is another like very tongue-in-cheek kind of role-playing game system, and that game I found was just like broken as hell. And it was like genuinely kind of frustrating just to like go through the process of like creating a character and stuff, although in a way it was kind of, I get that was part of the game, but like, yeah, it's weird.
Most amusing. As with so many things on the internet, it starts with a joke, and then it just becomes an actual thing.
Speaking of actual things, what is the actual thing that you have brought to the tavern?
Well, I actually brought three things. I dipped back into the Encyclopedia Magica. It's been a while. And I found three bizarre magic items. First is the painting of the Watchers. It's worth 12,000 gold pieces. At first glance, it's a painting of a forest. But if you look closely, you'll notice menacing eyes watching from the underbrush. And if you look at the painting too long, you might be drawn into the consciousness of one of the small woodland animals depicted in the painting, as long as there's a similar creature nearby the painting's real location. Then your mind becomes that of the animals, and you'll stay inside the consciousness of the woodland critter unless somebody stops you from looking at the painting.
So there has to be like a squirrel near the painting, and then
yeah,
I
so like if you're in an NPC's house.
Because at first I thought
house,
this was some Doom Patrol shit where my mind went into a squirrel that lived in a painting.
No, nothing so interesting. It's literally like a mind-swapping painting. On the condition that there is an
like
animal of the type in the painting nearby.
It's a telepathic mind swap relay designed for woodland critters only.
Exactly.
I do like the idea of that painting, though.
I mean, it would be a fun thing to sort of put just like randomly inside an NPC's abode.
The thing is, what
but
you really
as,
want to
as
do.
As a magic item, it's not the kind of thing that has much use outside of a curiosity.
I mean, the thing, what you really want to do, now that I think of it, is just do the plot line from Doom Patrol with the painting that ate Paris, and have a quest line where the players get sucked into a painting that is eating a whole world.
That's way more interesting than I think was intended with the painting of the Watchers. Or how about this? Speaking of extremely specific uses, Blastfor's magical diapers and crib of pushing.
I don't like this.
It is a magical set of diapers that instantly transmutes the waste of anyone wearing it into a mixture of 95% pure oxygen and 5% talcum. The magical crib is self-rocking and holds a milk bladder, as well as a toy parrot that hangs around the crib, watching the crib's occupant and chirping at them amusingly. The crib of pushing will rock back and forth while its occupant cries, will feed its inhabitant, as well as transmute any spills or other accidents that might be had.
I mean, I like to have one of those suits that, like, deals with that kind of thing, but, like, I just don't like the imagery.
Yeah, you know, like, what... This is another one of those ones I've talked about before with the Encyclopedia Magica, where you read it and you go, like, oh, okay, this was created for a very specific scenario in someone's campaign, and then somehow it made it into an official publication, which was then sourced.
Same with the woodland creature painting as well. Like,
I mean, the woodland creature painting, at least it's there's sort of like an amusing, there are some amusing possibilities that we discussed. But you know what, this, the magic diapers and crib, to me, that is like, okay, someone's character in a campaign has had a baby, but they want to go off an adventure and they don't want to just leave. They don't want to take the baby with them, but they don't want to leave the baby alone. So
but
what do you do?
You would do
some magic
nowadays,
diapers and a magic crib.
But what you would do nowadays is you just get that crib that Baby Yoda has.
Oh, yeah, of course. A hover crib. I mean, that would be much more useful.
My alarm's going off. One sec. You know what the alarm is supposed to tell me?
What?
Get up and do this damn recording.
Made it. Take that alarm.
Yeah, I'm practically done now. And finally?
And finally, the Cabinet of Ministering. This is easily the most useful of these three items. Still pretty funny. This magical cabinet is 5 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and 3 feet deep. Anything shoved inside when a command word is spoken is administered to, having a curse removed, a disease cured, or healed for up to 50 Ooh. Points worth of healing. You can carry it wherever you go, of course.
Pod.
Just keep it out of melee, because it can be easily damaged. But, and this is just a side note, it's nice to be able to say, quick, the paladin's almost dead, shove him in the box.
True. But, yeah, that's a good one. I would definitely skin that one as some sort of, like, you know, that, like, back-to-tank healing pod that Luke Skywalker was in. But, you know, I was also thinking about that painting again, and, like, here's an idea for listeners. If you want to run a sick game sometime, just take the premise from Mario 64, where you got the castle full of paintings, you got to jump in the paintings, do the quests. That'd be a great campaign.
I mean, even just a fun, like, single adventure premise could be somebody stares at the painting and their mind goes into a woodland creature, and then the woodland creature's mind goes into their body, and then somebody removes the painting, making the swap permanent until the painting can be found again.
Sounds like that Samurai Jack episode where he got turned into, a chicken?
A chicken, yeah. So there you go. Three unusual items. The painting of the Watcher, the Cabinet of Ministering, and Blastfor's magical diapers and the Crib of Pushing.
And there's three dope campaign ideas. The one where the painting eats everything, the one where it's Mario 64, and the one where it's Samurai Jack and he turns into a chicken.
But all of them to do with just the painting, though. Nothing to do with those diapers.
Yeah, that's just a way of explaining away stuff in a campaign.
Magical convenience.
But I, by all means, have that Baby Yoda crib, because that thing's cool. See that bit where Baby Yoda closes the crib himself because he knows some shit's going to go down. That's like, everybody should have that for their little baby companion.
He's not Baby Yoda anymore, though.
Oh, I haven't caught up to the new episode or anything.
Oh, I won't spoil it, but he's got a name now.
Okay, well, that's exciting. Meanwhile, I think it's time we wrapped up this episode.
Think so.
think it shaved off about 10 minutes, this short op of mine, but hey, that's how it happens sometimes. It's how it happened that time. That's why we're telling the story this way. It's how it happened. If you want to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Narnog. NAR_NOG. Want to get in touch with us in general, or follow the page, the podcast on Facebook. Check us out on Facebook, Compare and Campaign. It's where I tend to share the updates for the new episodes if you're not already following us on Spotify and or wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, if you want to check out supplemental material where we post basically our show notes, things that we've been referencing, things like in the very first post, we got the map of Drail, which I tend to go back to a lot when I'm telling my stories. You can check us out on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. Anything else, McGill?
Level up your characters.
Not me.
If you don't level up, then you don't get that sweet spell that undoes the entire adventure.